Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the victory of Proposition 8 in California has, at least for the moment, put the brakes on gay marriage in that state. The post-election recriminations are flying, but the main story we're hearing is that black voters turned out in droves to support Barack Obama and to defeat gay marriage rights. Is that narrative correct? We'll ask journalist Kai Wright. Also on Counterspin today, according to the New York Times, Newsweek, and NPR, among others, for Barack Obama to keep his promise to close the Guantanamo detention camp and deal with the detainees will be next to impossible, extremely complicated, and easier said than done. You could get the idea that some journalists would like to put off resolving the problems created by a Bush policy to isolate detainees and totally deprive them of rights. We'll discuss Guantanamo, Obama's promise, and the media with journalist Andy Worthington, the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
As President-elect Obama fills out his cabinet, there is a discussion in the corporate media about the ideological direction of the incoming administration. The media have long preferred Democrats to run and then govern from what they consider the middle, which for some reason is often treated as an area free of ideology or pesky politics. Obama's selection of Congressman Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff has been viewed through this skewed prism. Writing in Time magazine, Karen Tumulty responded to Republican complaints about Emanuel being too partisan by noting, quote, "Emanuel is a win-at-any-cost partisan, but not an ideologue. In his earlier White House stint as a top aide to Clinton, he was a key figure in shepherding through the North American Free Trade Agreement, a crime bill, and welfare reform. None of them popular with the Democratic Party's liberal base." Close quote. So promoting a punitive crime bill, a corporate-friendly trade deal, and slashing government assistance to poor families is not ideological. It's just media-approved common sense. For what it's worth, Tumulty's characterization of this as being a win-at-all-cost strategy could use some scrutiny as well. When Clinton Democrats pushed these policies, their party lost seats in Congress and in state government. Defying the party base is popular with the corporate media, but it seems less popular with voters.
The most talked-about Obama cabinet story, though, is the widespread speculation that Senator Hillary Clinton is in the running to be Obama's Secretary of State. On Fox News Sunday on November 16th, NPR reporter Mara Liasson offered her take on why picking Clinton made sense, a position essentially the same as that of her neocon co-panelist, Bill Kristol. Quote, "In terms of Obama, I think he wants, it would send a lot of important signals. Number one, she is hawkish, as Bill pointed out. He has to kind of put to rest this notion that he was naive, which of course came from her during the campaign." Close quote. So Clinton's hawkish, and this will balance out Obama's dovish naivete. If this is supposed to be a reference to the fact that Clinton supported the Iraq War, it makes little sense, unless one thinks being a hawk on Iraq was a sign of wisdom. Even with the election in the rearview mirror, some pundits can't shake the idea that Obama still has something to prove when it comes to foreign policy. Namely, he needs to move right.
In the November 18th New York Times article, "Clout Has Plunged for Automakers and Union, Too," reporter Micheline Maynard made the curious observation that the heads of both GM and the United Auto Workers, quote, "appeared on local TV in Detroit this week, but no Detroit representatives landed spots on the Sunday morning talk shows out of Washington," close quote. While it might be odd for a CEO like Rick Wagoner of GM to have trouble getting on the TV talk show circuit, the lack of a labor spokesperson on the Sunday shows is pretty much par for the course. In fact, it would have been really odd for a labor leader to be invited on a national program. When Fares Magazine Extra surveyed Sunday morning guests from 1995 and 6 and 1999, we found that of the 364 guests invited during the 19 months studied, only two were labor leaders. And MSNBC host Chris Matthews once noted, quote, "I never see a really good, articulate labor leader on television," close quote. And why not? Matthews explained, quote, "They don't have speakers. I'm telling you, I can't think right now of a labor leader that could match wits with a Dick Cheney on television. They don't want to get out there and debate like they used to," close quote. Of course, the idea that labor leaders, even those with Cheney-like wit, don't want to be on TV is absurd. When Matthews' guest, Bill Moyers, pointed that out, Matthews quipped, "Well, they should get elected to Congress. Then we will put them on." Matthew's joke provided a more sensible answer to his question. There aren't more labor leaders on Sunday shows because those shows are reserved for powerful politicians, and it's powerful journalists like Matthew's that have decided this should be the case.
The Washington Post ran an editorial about Nicaragua on November 16th that began, quote, "Through much of the 1980s, the United States waged a proxy war to prevent Daniel Ortega and his Sandinista party from consolidating a dictatorship in Nicaragua. In 1990, Mr. Ortega finally agreed to hold a presidential election, which he lost," close quote. Well, actually, Nicaragua held a presidential election in 1984, which Ortega won, getting 67% of the vote against six other candidates in an election judged by international observers to be free and fair. He faced another election in 1990, which he did lose because the Sandinista written constitution mandated presidential elections every 6 years. But the 1984 election, fittingly enough, seems to have gone down the memory hole at the Washington Post. To add irony to the Post's historical revisionism, the paper reported at the time on a secret, sensitive briefing paper from Reagan's National Security Council that outlined a, quote, "wide-ranging plan to convince Americans that the Nicaraguan elections were a sham," close quote. Now the Post is proof that the plan worked, or maybe they now see themselves as part of the plan.
And finally, radio talker Glenn Beck has been telling a personal story illustrating what he says is a particularly intense level of hatred on the left. The newly signed Fox News host says he was verbally assaulted while standing in line at a Wendy's restaurant. Beck says a truck driver called him, among other things, a racist bigot. Beck was shocked by this level of hate. Quote, "I wanted to say, I think you have me mistaken for someone else, but I knew he knew who I was, and he just hated me for who I was. Wow, is this who we've become?" Close quote. Beck concluded his appeal for civility by explaining that he wouldn't treat his enemies this way. Quote, "I could stand in line with Michael Moore, and I wouldn't say that to him. I would say some things to Michael Moore, but it wouldn't be that. Is this who we've become? I believe there is a cauldron of hatred on both sides, but the left is quite frightening," close quote. While Beck might not say such things to Michael Moore in person, he has said some things about him on his nationally syndicated radio show, namely that he wanted to kill him. 3 years ago, Beck declared, quote, "I'm thinking about killing Michael Moore, and I'm wondering if I could kill him myself or if I would need to hire somebody to do it. No, I think I could," close quote. And Beck wasn't exactly the picture of civility 2 years earlier when he told his listeners, quote, "Every night I get down on my knees and pray that Denis Kucinich will burst into flames," close quote. Whatever the truth is about Beck's truck driver story, his own record of hatred is clear, including a prediction that in 10 years' time, Muslims and Arabs will be looking through a razor wire fence at the West. If Glenn Beck really wants to know who we've become, maybe he should start by listening to his own words.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group Fair. Fair also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show.
For many, the success of California's Proposition 8 ballot initiative was the very bad news on an otherwise very good election night. Proposition 8 overturns, for now at least, the marriage rights for gays and lesbians in that state. In the aftermath, unsurprisingly, fingers are being pointed in different directions, and most of the energy has gone toward blaming black voters. As the story goes, African Americans came out strong to help elect Barack Obama and at the same time denied marriage rights to gays and lesbians. Does this blame game make sense? Kai Wright wrote about this subject for TheRoot.com, where he's a regular contributor. He joins us now to talk about it. Kai Wright, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this story seems to start with an exit poll. Black voters seem to overwhelmingly support Proposition 8. The Washington Post declared a couple days after the election, most of California's black voters backed gay marriage ban. 53% of Latinos also supported Proposition 8. The idea seems to be that, hey, numbers don't lie. What's wrong with that take on the story, do you think?
Well, any number of things. First off, numbers do lie, particularly exit polls. We have seen at some length that exit polls lie. And in this one in particular, when we're talking about race, it's difficult to draw any actual conclusions from it. There's been some really great work from smarter minds than I, ranging from the the folks at 538.com to a particular keen blogger at Daily Coast who have pointed out that it's just impossible for these numbers to add up, given how many black folks are actually in California, one, and then two, given the way that some black people are clumped in just a handful of counties. It's difficult to draw any real race-based conclusions from the exit poll, you know. But beyond the numbers, there's the bigger picture of why it was necessary. Why we suddenly, as a community, we being the gay community, started pointing fingers based on race. And that, I think that begs a lot of larger questions.
Yeah, I saw Nate Silver from 538 was pointing out that these new voters, i.e. the people who turned out for the first time to support Obama, they were overwhelmingly no voters. And if you cut the electorate any other way, church attendance, age, you would find more significant blocks of the population voting in favor of Proposition 8. The cover of The Advocate magazine announces gay is the new black. The piece that this refers to is more nuanced than that, but that's been one of the reactions from gay writers. How could black voters have turned their back on us? Dan Savage probably being the most prominent example of this. What did you make of that reaction when it surfaced?
I honestly think it reflects the level of entitlement in the white gay community. I mean, I think that an entitlement that has been a barrier to us getting civil rights for many, 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 many years. Folks who had a substantive interest in engaging communities of color have been telling the gay rights movement, listen, your white face act is a problem in terms of getting people in our community to support these rights, one. Two, the fact that you then, after ignoring communities of color, then turn around and appropriate communities of color's history in making your case for rights makes it even more difficult, you know. And so I think that, and I think all of that comes from a level of entitlement and a belief that, one, you don't have to do anything to earn rights, which people of color, and gay people of color included, have known for years, have always known you've got to do in America, sadly. And two, this idea that we're all in bed together when they've done nothing to put us in bed together, despite the fact that gay activists of color have been trying for years to get the gay movement to do that. And so laying aside the question about whether or not it is even statistically reasonable to blame people of color for the loss in California or any other gay rights loss, even if they were to blame, the real question here is why has the gay rights movement consistently failed to meaningfully engage communities of color while appropriating their history at the same time? If that continues, we'll continue to lose.
And some of the Proposition 8 campaigning was, I don't want to use the word clever, but that might be the way you talk about it. There were robocalls going out with Barack Obama's voice saying he was against gay marriage. So people who received those calls may have put two and two together and figured, well, he must be coming out in favor of this proposition. I guess there was no pushback toward that.
Well, you know, sadly, the Obama campaign did not do anything meaningful around challenging that themselves. But, you know, that reflects the fact that, you know, the right has for a while gotten it. They get it that, you know, you have to engage these communities. And they use the lies and all kinds of other mess to play to the worst in black communities and in other communities of color, and have always done so. And they're succeeding at it. And if we cede that ground as a movement, we, again, being the gay movement, if we cede that ground, we'll continue to get beat in it. And if we actually go in there and engage, then we might be able to build an actual real coalition instead of one that exists only in the heads of some of these white gay writers.
Well, trying to get in the heads of the mainstream media, though, why do you think this story appeals to them so much? Is this just conflict for the sake of conflict, or is there something deeper going on, that there's something intrinsically appealing about this gay community versus African-American community
split?
Well,
you know, it's a terribly compelling storyline, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we've elected the first black president, but black people themselves are bigots. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a terribly compelling storyline, and you know what drove it. I think people were looking for a contrarian story to tell on the day after the election, and I think on some levels it's just that banal. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that, again, I am less interested in how the media covers it than I am in what and then how the gay community responds to it and how the gay community, what the gay community has done to perpetuate it rather than to deal with it. And I should stress also what the black community is doing. So all of this does not let off the fact that if even one African American voted, if even one Latino voted, if even one person of color voted for that initiative, they ought to be ashamed of themselves. And we need to be doing something about that. But instead of doing something about that, we're busy playing this bizarre blame game, and that's not going to get us anywhere.
Well, your piece and others like it have been pointing toward a conversation that we could be having or people should be having. Is there a sense that that's starting to happen either in California or anywhere else, do you think?
Well, I mean, not that I can see. Now, I'm not in California, so I'm not going to say, and I'm not behind the doors of some of these movement leaders, and so I'm not going to say what they're thinking. I know that folks I've talked to, some gay activists of color who have been in conversations with movement leaders and movement funders since the initiative are dispirited at the nature of the conversation. They don't see anyone getting that there needs to be a change thus far. Now, you know, the wounds are still fresh. Mm-hmm. One of the neat things, though, that is occurring is a few days back, we had these series of rallies around the country for gay rights. I was at the one here in New York, and they were organized in an almost entirely grassroots fashion. You know, they were organized through Facebook largely. A lot of folks came just because they saw it on Facebook. And in those cases, the traditional leadership is sort of playing catch-up to what was coming from the ground up. And it was notable to me that while on the stage at the New York rally, we still saw the usual cast of white men and women, that in the rallies on the ground, at least here in New York, I saw a much more diverse and a much younger crowd than I am accustomed to seeing. And that's hopeful. It still needs to be far more of both, but that's hopeful.
We've been speaking with Kai Wright. You can read his article, The Proposition 8 Blame Game, at theroot.com. Read his other work at kaiwright.com. Kai Wright, thanks for joining us this week here on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Stories about the disposition of the Guantanamo detention camp and its detainees, and President-elect Barack Obama's promise to shut it down, have largely focused on how keeping that promise might be, as NPR's Morning Edition put it on November 13th, easier said than done. No one is arguing that closing Guantanamo won't be complicated. There will be many problems arising from the Bush administration's policies, which were designed to deprive detainees of any rights at all. Bringing them back into some sort of legal process may not be easy, but it will have to be dealt with sooner or later. To read the U.S. media with its marshaling of sources and facts suggesting that closing the camp will be next to impossible, one might get the impression some journalists would like to put off resolution of the Guantanamo question. Joining us now to discuss Guantanamo and its detainees is Andy Worthington. He's the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. Andy Worthington, welcome back to Counterspin.
Hello. Sorry, good to be here.
Well, in addition to National Public Radio, The New York Times and Newsweek, among other media outlets, have also featured reports suggesting that closing Guantanamo would pose daunting problems. Well, I don't know if anyone is saying the problems the Bush White House created with its policies toward detainees are easy ones. One might get the impression that journalists just want to put off the issue, as I mentioned. What's your reaction to that sort of treatment of the Guantanamo question?
Well, I have the feeling that whether some journalists intend to or not, they've slightly been swayed by the government's arguments over the years about the numbers of dangerous people that are held, and they're worried about them being released and what might happen as a result of that. Now, I have to say that although clearly there are some dangerous people there, the important way to look at this is to really analyze what's actually happened over the years as to how these people were rounded up, you know, for bounty payments, how little and how inadequate was the screening process to determine who was there, how many innocent people have been held and how many people who had no connection whatsoever with Al-Qaeda. And to approach it from a skeptical point of view about an administration which genuinely behaved as though everybody was guilty and that proving any kind of innocence was going to be extraordinarily difficult. I think from that angle, it makes the problem a lot less serious than some journalists have been proposing.
We've been told that they're the worst of the worst. What is the actual breakdown? You've mentioned, I think, three basic categories of detainees at Guantanamo.
Well, sure. In some ways, the most difficult group to deal with imminently is 50, at least, prisoners who have been cleared for release. Approved for transfer is actually how it's phrased in a lot of cases. The administration, of course, over the years has been desperate never to admit that it made any mistakes. But these are people who, after multiple review boards, military review boards, have been approved for release from Guantanamo. Now, these people are from countries including China, Libya, Tunisia, Uzbekistan, countries with severely poor human rights records. And it has been extraordinarily difficult to try and find new homes for these men over the years. So that's one category. Another category, of course, is the genuinely dangerous people who've been put forward for trial by military commission at Guantanamo, this being the novel trial system for terror suspects that was invented particularly by Dick Cheney and his close advisors after 9/11. And in between these two categories of prisoner, there are about 125 prisoners who are described as being too dangerous to release but not guilty enough to prosecute. I'm sure that you don't even really need a legal mind to question whether that's any kind of basis really for holding people. So those are the three categories.
Well, we've got the problem that with some of these detainees, testimony was obtained through torture. How do you see that being resolved in coming into some sort of new legal process? What do you think is the proper resolution in general to the Guantanamo question?
When you look in detail at the allegations against so many of these prisoners, and I mean, it's something that I have looked into in great detail, what you find so often is that allegations against prisoners were produced sometimes through the torture of other prisoners, I think it's clear, but at least through the coercion of other prisoners or sometimes actually through bribery. I mean, other prisoners were offered better living conditions if they came up with stories against other prisoners. Some of this is really quite easy to see and to analyze when looking through the allegations against prisoners. So to that extent, I think looking at what's available on the prisoners with an objective eye, it really ought to be clear that most of these people shouldn't be there. Now, the difficult issue, of course, is with the people genuinely suspected of serious wrongdoing, perhaps involved with the 9/11 attacks even, and the horrible history of their detention in secret CIA custody and the use of torture on them. And to be honest, I don't have any easy answer for this. Holding them forever, as the Bush administration has been doing without charge or trial, would clearly not be appropriate. The issue that's scaring a lot of people is obviously how to put them on trial with this issue of torture being there. And I have to say that I think that the only way really that the new administration can do this is to draw a line under what's happened before, so to categorically declare that the United States is not going to be involved in torture in the future, to close down the CIA's operations of extraordinary rendition, of the secret prisons it's been running, of its extraordinary rendition of people to other countries to be tortured, to clean up America's act, and then to say, well, look, with these small number of people, and I'm suspecting really that it's dozens, we're going to have to put them on trial and we're going to have to find a way to do this without really opening the door to this torture story, because, it's a difficult one. It really is the thorniest issue of all, is how you manage to sidestep the torture issue. And I think that by declaring a new start, but by also having to admit that, you can't let these guys go, that would have to be the way forward.
Well, as opposed to journalists who don't seem eager to confront these tough questions, what would you advise? How would you advise journalists to report on Guantanamo and Obama's promise to shut it down?
Well, I think they should just be a little bit more quizzical about about who's actually there. I think the easiest thing for people to do is to get into this notion that these people are somehow quite dangerous. But, I'm not talking about the really dangerous people. I'm just talking about, in general, the people who are there. Because there are still, over 250 prisoners there. held for nearly 7 years without charge or trial, which is frankly an intolerable situation. And it really requires looking into whether these people are genuinely dangerous. And that's why I think people need to know the backstory. They need to know that 85% of the prisoners who ended up in Guantanamo were not caught by U.S. forces. They were caught by their Afghan or Pakistani allies for the most part. And the U.S. military was offering substantial bounty payments for al-Qaeda and Taliban suspects. The prisoners in Afghan custody were not screened by the U.S. military. They didn't hold battlefield tribunals, according to the Geneva Conventions, where witnesses can be called. And they've been used in all previous conflicts to separate soldiers from people caught up in the fog of war. And when they got to Guantanamo, after 2.5 years, when the Supreme Court said, these guys have habeas corpus rights, you can't hold them forever without charging them with anything, without saying what they've done. Instead of them going into the court system, the administration introduced these tribunals, the Combatant Status Review Tribunals. These are the ones where the prisoners weren't allowed legal representation, weren't allowed to see or hear the classified evidence against them. And these are the documents that are available that, when they're scrutinized, reveal that so many of the stories against these people are these kind of unsubstantiated allegations that I've been talking about. And they're looking at all of those demonstrates that really there are genuinely very few dangerous people in Guantanamo, and there's no problem with releasing these men.
We've been speaking with Andy Worthington. He's the author of The Guantanamo Files, the stories of 774 detainees in America's illegal prison. You can read his commentary on Guantanamo on his website at www.andyworthington.co.uk. Andy Worthington, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. You can also listen to Counterspin at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.